Hello, Bartow County listeners, and more importantly, Southeast Bartow County listeners. This is definitely for you. This is Mike Garcia here in the studio of WBHF. I'm very pleased to bring you Titus Nichols. He is one of the two Democratic candidates for State Senate District 37. Thank you so much for agreeing to be on this forum.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be on. I'm grateful for any opportunity that I can to talk to people in the district.
So as everyone is well aware, well, maybe not everyone, but you definitely are, everything's been reapportioned. So now District 37, not part of Bartow County before, is now. Can you go ahead and introduce yourselves to those folks?
So my name is Titus Nichols. I'm running to be the next state senator for District 37. Now, District 37, under the new map that has been drawn, includes Cobb County and Bartow, particularly the southeast corner of Bartow County. The city of Emerson is now included in the same district as Cobb County. Within Cobb County, my district will include Acworth, Kennesaw, unincorporated Marietta, unincorporated Powder Springs. So pretty much just about all of northwest Cobb and then southeast corner of Bartow County.
So talk about everything that you've accomplished up to this point. I know you've got a lot on your plate. I was reading your bio, and you're an attorney now, and you were in JAG, and get people caught up to speed on your background.
So I am an attorney. I own my own law practice, Nichols Injury Law. I represent regular people who have been hurt. I also serve in the George Army National Guard. I'm third generation military. My grandfather served in the Pacific Theater in World War II. My father served two tours in Vietnam with the Air Force. And then I'm going on my seventh year serving in the Army as a JAG officer or a military lawyer. I also serve as an adjunct or part-time professor at my law school, University of Georgia School of Law. I'm running on the Democrat ticket to be the next state senator. I believe that Cobb and Bartow County, they're changing. And we as a district, we can either embrace the change or we can be consumed by it. So I think it's very important just to focus on the issues that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, the national issues we could spend all day going back and forth about. But what I really want to focus my campaign on are what's going to put food on the table, what's going to affect our kids' education. Just looking at the city of Emerson, since 2000, the population has increased by 34%. And it's not just the population has increased, it's become more diverse. The Latino population has gone from less than 3% to 14% of just Emerson. And so when I say that change is coming, it's not just a slogan, it's pointing out the reality. And we as a community, if we want our communities to grow, we have to be in the best position to embrace that change.
So let's go ahead and dive into, there's a whole bunch of things. We can talk for a while, but we both got other things to do. So let's go ahead. I know one topic that's been floating around, and people look at surrounding states and see, you know, how can Georgia remain competitive with other states and many different aspects of society. But a lot of people look at the economics, and there's been a lot of talk about changing the state income tax. What are your feelings on how it is currently, and would you do anything to change that?
So I know that originally, when the idea was first proposed in the state house, there was the idea, or the state legislature, there was the idea of just completely eliminating the income tax. That I did not support, because if you do that, you're going to affect our education. Because of our $30 billion budget in the state of Georgia, education represents, I believe, about either 10 or 13 billion. If you take away the state income tax, how are we going to fill that gap that's undoubtedly going to hurt education? And the reason why I'm tying state income tax to education is because that's how we fund our education. I grew up going to public schools. When I was in the first grade, I could not read that well. I struggled. I mean, I struggled to the point where I had to look at the name tag on my locker just to spell my last name. Thankfully, my school had the funding to start a pilot reading program where every day I would go read with Mrs. Sierwinski. I couldn't pronounce Sierwinski as a little kid, so I called her Mrs. C. So every day I would go read with Mrs. C, and Mrs. C would give me reading assignments. I needed that program because my mother was a single parent raising me and my sisters. She didn't have the privilege to just sit down and read with me every night to help me. And so because of that program, I was able to become a better reader. And now here I am as a lawyer. Again, I tie that back to our income tax. We have to be very careful about how we reduce taxes, because if we know that what has passed in the legislature was a reduction down to 4.9, we have to be very mindful about what we're taking and what we're putting back into the pot. So that's my position, is that if there's going to be any change to our income tax, we first have to ask the question, can we still continue to fund our education?
And then before we get to education, because I've got a lot of things to tackle there, let's talk about the economic repercussions from the pandemic. And you've seen certain businesses get more affected than others and whatnot. How would you assess the state handled that?
I really believe that the state spent too much time picking these unnecessary fights over masks. You saw the lawsuit that Governor Kemp filed against the city of Atlanta, but then dismissed the lawsuit after it became obvious that he did not have any legal ground to stand on. What was the benefit of that? How many lives did that save by picking a fight over masks? I'll be the first one to tell you, I didn't like wearing masks, but I still wear it. Whenever I go to my daughter's daycare, they still require that every single adult that walks into that building wear a mask. Do I like it? No. Do I do it? Yes, I do. Because it's not about what I individually want. It's about the safety of others. So I believe the state did do a good job in eventually embracing the science and the medicine, but it just picked too many unnecessary fights. Additionally, I believe the state failed to provide proper unemployment assistance to the citizens. Talking to different people in the district, I've heard so many stories about how when they were trying to apply for unemployment, they either couldn't get in touch with anyone at the labor office or the unemployment office, or they were just put into this limbo where they never got an official response when they filed a request. So there's more work. I mean, heaven forbid we have another economic crisis like that. But there's more that the state can do to be in the best position to look out for its citizens when they do have that type of problem.
Give me an example. If you were in the Senate seat at that point, is there anything that you would have proposed or looked at, or did you see any other ideas that weren't implemented? What give me an example.
I definitely would have put more emphasis on proper preparing schools to handle the pandemic. Unfortunately, our students, they are the unfortunate victims as well, because they lost time in school. Now, granted, you have large school districts such as Cobb, that they were in a better position to deal with going remote than compared to smaller school districts. That's a problem. The fact that your level of education depends on whether you go to a big or a small school district is not something that's acceptable, because that's a year and a half to 2 years that these students have been physically out of the classroom, and there wasn't a definitive uniform plan for how the schools were going to address this issue and how to safely bring the kids back into school.
Speaking of education, I know you obviously you had just mentioned that you went to a public school in Georgia, and you have is your daughter school age yet?
Yeah, so I went to a school in Ohio, but my daughter, she's in daycare right now. She's 2 years old.
Okay.
So
okay.
We live right down the street from our local elementary school, so in about 3 years we'll be knocking on that door.
Okay. And so how would you assess the current state of education in the state of Georgia?
As I said before, Cobb has the, I guess, advantage of being the second largest school district. So as Cobb goes, so does the rest of Georgia. So in Cobb County, it's a larger district, much more funding, and you also have a lot more programs that are available for students. You can't really say that for other school districts. And so one big problem we have in Georgia is funding. We have what's called the QBE, the Qualified Basic Education. It's a formula that we use to determine how to fund the schools. The problem is that formula was created in the 80s. So we're still going off of a formula from decades ago. And since its creation, it's only been fully funded maybe 2-3 times. As the school, as I said before, Emerson is growing. Cobb County is growing. Bartow is growing. As these districts continue to grow, we need to readdress how much we're funding, because we have a crisis where teachers are leaving the profession because they feel underappreciated, underpaid. As the student population grows, we have to make sure that we're still continuing the sufficient funding to properly pay our teachers and provide the programs that our students need.
Now, as far as the quality, and again, there are so many metrics out there, it's unbelievable. Is there any one or two that you look at and you say, we're in the right direction, let's keep it going? Or is it something that's like, we need to do something different because this isn't working? How do you see that?
So, like I said, with the Quality Basic Education, or QBE, we need to take a look at it again and find out, is it still working for Georgia in 2022? I know that particularly in Cobb County, as far as funding, one issue that if I was in the Senate that I would really push for is providing more mental health services to the school systems. And some people probably think, well, what does mental health have to do with kids? There are a lot of children who they have issues. I don't want to say that they have, mental disorders, but they have issues. Issues that can be properly addressed by interacting with medical professionals. Unfortunately, your average person doesn't know a therapist. They don't know them. They don't go to them. And the child has an issue, does not have interaction with them. And I'm a former prosecutor. I've seen too many times where the first time a person interacts with a mental health specialist is when they're in prison, or when they're in the court system. And there's a lot of problems that could be alleviated if we were to provide more mental health experts or mental health professionals within the school system. When I was growing up, my school actually had a dedicated school counselor, not a guidance counselor, but an actual school therapist. Unfortunately, because of budget cuts, a lot of school districts have to share their therapists throughout the districts, as opposed to having a definitive one within the school, or perhaps having a definitive one, one for every 250 students. Just something that can be done so that you're getting to the students before a problem happens.
But now, as far as I guess what people like to call the reading, writing, arithmetic type of deal and STEM and all that, how do you think the state's doing in comparison to other states?
We're doing good in regards to promoting STEM. I mean, it's obvious that STEM is going to be the future. We have numerous magnet schools that focus on STEM starting at the third grade, which is great because now you're exposing the child to such an important factor early on, instead of trying to get them at high school and say, hey, why don't you start being interested in math and engineering and everything else? So I think we're doing good in that regard. But again, it goes back to, we can have one or two programs here or there, but if we're not properly funding our education system, then we're going to have this imbalance, where if you're fortunate enough to be in a city that has a STEM program, you're in good condition. But if you're not, well, then you're just out of luck.
What is your stance on school choice, whether it be vouchers or charter schools or anything like that?
As a state senator, I'm not going to support any legislation that takes money out of public schools to fund private schools. Now, that's not to say that I'm declaring war on private schools. If you believe that's the best choice for your family, then by all means, go for it. There are great private schools. I went to public school. My younger sister went to private school when we were coming up. So it's not one versus the other. But what I don't support is taking money out of the pockets of public schools to fund it.
Okay. And is there anything that you feel needs to be added to education that we're not doing, or something that needs to be removed from education, or you find with the curriculum the way it is? What's your take?
I think our elected officials, right now we have a crisis in Georgia in regards to teachers leaving the profession. They're not being paid properly and they're not receiving enough support. Instead of addressing that crisis, our elected officials at the state level are waging these imaginary wars against these curriculums that don't exist. And they're doing that because those are easy battles. If I pick an argument with you over whatever curriculum. Guess what? Now me and you are going to spend time arguing over this one thing instead of me having to address this difficult subject of how do I keep teachers? How do I bring students back into the classroom who have been out of it for a year and a half? That's a hard solution to come to. And instead of focusing on the hard choices, our leaders are picking these imaginary battles. And at the end of the day, it's not going to move the needle. It's not going to teach one child how to read or how to do basic finance or properly prepare them to be a working citizen in the real world. That's what I think we in Georgia need to get back to, is focusing on educating our children and not waging these imaginary wars.
As far as healthcare is concerned, again, assess your opinion, the state of healthcare here in the state.
It is no question. The state of Georgia is dead last in regards to providing mental health services to people that need them. I will give credit to the Cobb County Sheriff's Office. They have embraced that by actually having mental health professionals available to work with law enforcement so that when they come to a scene and there's someone who obviously has a mental health episode, it's not going to a gun first. Instead, it's using other tools to address the situation. In regards to healthcare in general, we need to expand Medicaid. Now, I am not advocating for Medicaid for all or anything like that. What I am saying is that the federal government has provided Georgia with $3.5 billion to expand its Medicaid program. If Georgia was to accept that $3.5 billion that's just sitting there, we could cover over 500,000 people in the state of Georgia right now who qualify for Medicaid but aren't within the system. The fact that we keep on playing these little games of trying to come up with these alternative programs that don't cover, like Governor Kemp made a proposal for an alternative to Medicaid expansion, but that expansion only would have covered 50,000 people in the state. We got 10.7 million people. 50,000 is a drop in the bucket. And unfortunately, our leaders are more focused on playing politics than providing protection to people. You have a lot of people who have to make a decision. Do I pay a doctor's bill or do I pay my rent? Do I pay rent for the month? That's an unfortunate decision no one should have to do. Fortunately, my mother, while even though she was just a single parent, she never had to make that decision because she had a job that provided her for with good health insurance. Not everybody has that option. Not everybody has insurance provided by their job. Maybe they're working in the gig economy where you don't have a good health insurance plan. So we as a state need to do more to provide that, not coddle people, but to basically give them access to affordable health insurance. If not the expansion of Medicaid, then we need to do what we can within our power to provide people access to health insurance they can afford.
So you were saying not expand it to all, but to whom would you expand it to?
Right now, we know for a fact that there are about 500,000 citizens in Georgia who meet the financial requirement of the expansion of Medicaid. So it's not as if we would create a brand new administrative state by doing so, or it's not as if we'd be giving a handout to anybody who's begging for it. There are 500,000 people who are low income, but they don't qualify for the current level of Medicaid. Whereas if we accepted $3.5 billion and expanded it to that financial level of poverty, those 500,000 people would be covered immediately.
And in doing so, would you propose relying on just what the state receives from the federal government, or how much of the state's chest, I guess you might say, would go to that?
The way the calculation is set up is that the federal government would provide $3.5 billion, or 90% of the funding, and the state of Georgia would provide 10%. Now, some people are saying, well, that's 10% out of our pocket. My response would be, how many rural hospitals are shutting down or on the verge of shutting down because uninsured people are the primary patients? And that's the reality. As much as people want to talk about, well, that's 10%, we shouldn't have to pay, hospitals are hurting. Because a lot of people who have no health insurance, what happens is they get hurt, they get sick, and their only form of treatment is going to the ER. The ER is not designed to resolve your problem. The ER is designed to make sure that you don't bleed to death. So you break your arm, you go to the ER. The ER puts you in a cast to make sure your arm is back together, but what about the follow-up treatment that you need in order to get back to work or to get back to your original position of health? We cannot put this burden on our hospitals to be the only medical resource that a lot of people have when we have the financial option of giving people access to affordable health insurance.
And does, from what you've seen, does Georgia right now have that 10%, or would they have to find a way to fund that 10%?
We would definitely have, we have it available. We just have to decide what we're going to put emphasis on. I mean, are we going to spend more time and more money arguing over imaginary curriculums, or are we going to find a way to properly fund this 10% so that we can provide this health insurance? Because again, it's an economic decision. If a person has access to Medicaid, then that means they're not using more of their money for health coverage. That's more money they can put back into the economy. So it's not, oh, you're just giving out free money to people. What you're doing is you're giving people stability so that they can use their economic resources to spur the economy.
And then you had briefly touched upon mental health. And you know, you talk about the work that the Cobb County Sheriff's Office has been doing, and I know I hear we talk to the Bartow County Sheriff here once a month, and you know, he says, look, he goes, the solution for these people isn't to go ahead and lock them up, because that's not going to do anything. The big elephant in the room, obviously, is how we go about funding mental health. Do you have a formula? Not so much just funding it, but just some kind of a model of how that should operate.
One bill that has just recently passed in the Georgia legislature, it's called HB 1013. It's called the Mental Health Parity Act. So what it means is that health insurance companies now have to treat funding for mental health the same way they do if you were to break your arm. What that means is that a lot of health insurance companies, they don't. So let's say you have, under your health insurance policy, you have a policy that allows you to go see a therapist and health insurance will cover a certain amount. Health insurance companies have not been providing the funding for that the same way they would provide funding if you went to your doctor for preventative care. And so it's essentially saying, oh, well, yeah, you're covered to go talk to a therapist, but you're on your own for the bill. What this law requires is now it's forcing insurance companies, and it's through state enforcement, it's forcing insurance companies to provide the same level of funding. And those are the steps that the state can take. The state itself can't create mental health services for people to cover the entire state. We have 10.7 million people. But they can use their power to enforce what's already there. And so bills like HB 1013 helps push the private health insurance companies to provide proper funding so people can go get the mental assistance they need.
Yeah.
Or mental health assistance they need.
Sure. And then another hot button issue, at least for the last couple of years, is how our state conducts elections. So before I get into any kind of nitty-gritty, just give me your assessment right now on the state of the Secretary of State's office and how we conduct our elections.
So you can already see that the Secretary of State is already feeling the wrath because he decided to tell the truth. There was no fraud in the 2020 election. There was no need for election security. Donald Trump lost. But as Democrats, we also have to accept that Donald Trump's not on the ballot anymore, so we can't focus so much on him. What I will focus on as a senator is supporting bills that allow the free and fair election rights for everybody. One of the recent bills, SB 202, that's the election law that has created all these restrictions. It is going to affect all Georgia voters. I'm not just saying, oh, well, it's going to infringe upon minorities or young people. No, it's going to hurt all voters, because there's, if you read the law, it does a lot of things to frustrate the ability to vote freely. One example, absentee ballot boxes. What the new law has done is it has shrunk the number of ballot boxes that are now available. It used to be you could go to the absentee drop box, drop off your ballot, and go on your merry way. Now, because of the law, the ballot box is no longer outside of the building. It's inside of one location, and you can only go during those hours that the building's open. So that means you've got to drive somewhere, find a parking spot, get out the car, wrangle all your kids, go into the building, stand in line, and then that's the only time you can use that feature. Let's say you have a work schedule that you're not able to get there when it's open. Well, you're just out of luck because that law has restricted your ability to vote freely. You also have the law that states that if you give food or water to somebody that's within 150 feet of an election site, you can be prosecuted. As a prosecutor, I think that is the stupidest law in the world. Why in the world are we drawing a distinction? If I give you a bottle of water at 149 feet, I've now committed a crime. But if I give you that same bottle of water at 151 feet, I haven't violated the law. It is stupid and arbitrary, and I honestly cannot see a reasonable prosecutor enforcing that law. But again, all of these little things are designed to frustrate a person's ability to vote freely. And that is why I believe these types of laws will hurt all Georgia voters.
Yeah, well, to my understanding, the drop boxes, I think, were kind of conceived out of the whole pandemic thing. And I think opponents cite, well, you know, it's easy for someone to break into these boxes if they're outside of the building and take ballots or stuff, whatever. How would you safeguard around that?
We didn't see that in 2020. I mean, like, it's one thing for opponents to come up with all these apocalyptic worst-case scenarios. It's something else to actually see it happen. If this was such a horrible threat, 2020, you had the largest turnout of voters. How many ballot boxes were busted open and votes stolen? You didn't see it. And so ballot box drops have been available since before the pandemic, and you didn't see people, gangs busting them open and stealing ballots and things like that. So yeah, a person can always engage in worst case scenario. The reality is it provided ability for people to vote freely and fairly. It provided opportunity for people who, for let's say for health reasons, could not stand in line for an hour to cast a vote. Or for whatever schedule reason, it was easier for them to just go drop off the absentee ballot, and now they've exercised their right as a citizen to vote. As a state senator, I will support all legislation that allows for legitimate Georgia voters to engage in the voting process.
As far as the actual election day, or I guess they do it for early voting too, it seems like every couple of years there's always some kind of new voting machine, a new process and whatnot. So your assessment on the current election process in the building?
I believe that leading up to 2020, the Secretary of State had a very secure process for us to cast a vote. I cast a vote, my wife cast a vote, my mother and sisters, we all cast votes. We didn't have any type of security issue. We didn't have any problem with any type of voting machine. It's just you have the Secretary of State office that has the ability to investigate legitimate claims of voter fraud. But what has happened is that what has happened is that in 2020, you have people engaged in these ridiculous conspiracy theories. And now these conspiracy theories are being given the same amount of credibility as what actually did happen. There is no conspiracy with Dominion voting machines. There is no server in Germany that was used to steal votes or whatever ridiculous conspiracy theory people come up with. And yet, the problem is people keep on pushing these ridiculous theories as if there's a semblance of truth to them. And so now that's why you see Secretary Raffensperger has multiple primary opponents who want to buy into these ridiculous conspiracies. We can debate on policy. I'm a Democrat, someone can be a Republican, they can be independent, they can be whatever. We can go back and forth on policy, but we have to acknowledge the same basic truth. The sky is blue, the grass is green, and the election of 2020 was not fraudulent. If people can't agree on that, then you're going to have trouble discussing any other policy that affects the state of Georgia.
Again, in case you're just tuning in, we're speaking with State Senate District 37 candidate Titus Nichols, the Democrat, one of the two Democrats running on the ticket. Got a couple of more questions before I let you go. And this one, while the Bartow voters, this may not pertain to you right now, but it's something to be aware of. As I'm sure you well know, there is Lost Mountain. They are trying to establish themselves as a city there in West Cobb. What are your feelings on this and the future of other incorporated areas that want to become cities?
So I'm troubled by the information that has been pushed forward about Lost Mountain. I'm troubled because as a state senator, I'm always going to operate on transparency. Whether someone agrees with me, disagrees with me, I'm all about being transparent. And unfortunately, the people that have been pushing Lost Mountain have not been transparent. If you read the feasibility study, is filled with speculation. It's filled with, we don't know how much this costs. We don't know how much that costs. Well, let's go look at Peachtree Corners. Or, well, we assume it'll cost X. I'm a business owner. There is no way I would make a long-term decision based upon a one-year speculative study. Because that's what the feasibility study is. The feasibility study says, hey, if you look at everything 1 year into the future, this is how much we think it is. So the proponents are saying that Lost Mountain can be ran on a budget of $9 million. I don't think that's possible. If created, the city of Lost Mountain will have a population of 72,000 citizens. That'll make it the 11th largest city in the state of Georgia. There's no way it can be ran on $9 million. Because what's going to happen is, in the military, we call it mission creep, where you start off with one objective, but then you add on to the point where you're doing something totally different. Lost Mountain's budget is not going to fit within $9 million. So, prime example, code enforcement. Right now in West Cobb represents a very small amount of the code violation. I think about 10% or whatever. And so you only have one code enforcer for the particular area. City of Lost Mountain wants to create 8 code enforcers, and each code enforcer is going to have a vehicle. They're saying that the vehicle is going to cost between $25,000 to $30,000. In what in today's world, where can you find a pickup truck for $30,000? Kelly Blue Book price right now is $45,000 for a pickup truck. So that right there demonstrates that their budget is not matching reality. Number two, their budget is not calculating the salaries for code enforcement. Parks and recreations. City of Lost Mountain will take over the parks within this area to the tune of $100 an acre. Okay, that's for the property. How do you maintain the property? That feasibility study doesn't make any mention of paying for the equipment like tractors that go for the tune of $80,000 per tractor for maintaining the property. What about the salaries of the individuals you'll need to maintain the parks? Cobb County right now, because it's a county, they can pool resources together to cover the parks. Lost Mountain won't have access to the same amount of resources as Cobb, so they're going to have to spend more money for the employees. And so it's, as you dive deep into the end, it's like those saying, the devil's in the details. As you start diving into the details, you come back up with more and more questions. Questions that the proponents have not been able to answer. And quite frankly, if you look at the website and who's pushing it, you're seeing that it's a lot of commercial real estate developers. So that really makes you ask a question, what is it that is making a commercial real estate developer want to create a brand new city? It certainly isn't to slow down development. So again, I say that because of the lack of transparency, I just, at this point, I just don't believe that it's going to be in the best interest of the taxpayers. And I really wish the proponents would be much more transparent about what it is they're trying to achieve with Lost Mountain.
Now, again, we did invite Titus's opponent, Vanessa Parker. She was not able to make it today, but now she is retired. So you would think on the surface she would have a lot more time to dedicate to the citizens of District 37. How would you go ahead and answer that and compare why you'd be a better choice than she would?
I believe I'm a better choice because I understand the importance of the people need to know who the leaders are. Now, I get it. This district will cover 192,000 people. I can't go and shake everyone's hand. But you should know who your state senator is. You should know who your state representative is. And with modern technology, there's no reason why people... our leaders, we can't be more accessible to the voters. Why you can't use email, Zoom, telephone, whatever technological feature to reach out to your representative so that if you have a problem, if you have some issue that falls within the state senator's wheelhouse, I can't respond and tell you, I hear your situation, I hear your problem, this is what I'm going to do, or let me follow up with you, or let me go see what your available options are. Or maybe you're asking for something that doesn't fall within my lane. Let's say you have a problem with a pothole in your neighborhood. Granted, that's not something a state senator does, but I'm not going to ignore you. I should be able to use my resources to say, okay, here's who you need to contact. Contact the Department of Transportation, or contact the city road department, or whomever is responsible. At the end of the day, that's our job as elected officials, is to be accessible. We can't talk to everybody at the same time, but we can use technology to be accessible.
All right, so I'll let you go ahead and give us one final pitch about why they should District 37 residents should entrust you with their vote.
So again, thank you for the opportunity to have me here to speak. I always appreciate the time to talk to people. I'm standing up to run because Cobb and Bartow County is changing, and we can either embrace the change or we can be consumed by it. We can spend time arguing back and forth over imaginary battles that don't really put food on the table or help educate our kids, or we can focus on the real tough problems we have in Georgia. I am a lawyer, I am a soldier, I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm a whole lot of things, but more importantly, I'm somebody that wants to do what's best for you, the citizen. Whether you're a Democrat, Republican, Independent, whomever you are, I would ask for your vote, and I'd be grateful for your vote because I believe I'm the best position to fight for you. Thank you.
Again, Titus, thank you very much for agreeing to this forum and introducing yourselves to our Bartow County side of your district. And again, a reminder, early voting beginning Monday, May 2nd, Election Day, May 24th. Go out and cast your vote. I see it time and time again. It seems like big turnouts come out on presidential years, but this is just as important as any other years, you know.
Yep, absolutely.
All right. Thanks a lot. Have a great one.
All right. Thank you.